Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was formerly the National Security Advisor for President Jimmy Carter. He's a counselor and trustee at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor of American Foreign Policy at the School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. And his new book is Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower. We'll be talking about the book and the general state of U.S. foreign policy, given that in his book, Zbigniew Brzezinski grades the three post-Cold War presidents, starting with George Herbert Walker Bush, who he gives a solid B, Bill Clinton an uneven C, and George W. Bush a failed F. So we'll be talking to Zbigniew Brzezinski in a moment, and then we'll talk about the Winograd Commission in Israel, a devastating report that essentially eviscerates the authority and reputation of the Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, and the Defense Minister. And it's an extraordinary document, and of course it leads one to question how Israel's democracy and press seem to work as opposed to ours, where our president has taken us into an incredibly disastrous and unpopular war that the country is mired in with no end in sight and no good options, only bad. And there is no Winograd Commission or any equivalent in this country. So we'll be talking to Daniel Levy, the Senior Fellow, Director of the Middle East Policy Initiative of the American Strategy Program at the New American Foundation. He was the lead Israeli drafter of the Geneva Initiative and directed policy planning and the international efforts at the Geneva campaign headquarters in Tel Aviv, and he's also a member of the Israeli delegation at the Taba negotiations with the Palestinians in January 2001 and on the negotiating team of the Oslo Agreement from May to September 1995 under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. And then we will speak with Frank Bowman, a longtime federal prosecutor. After he graduated from Harvard Law School, he then entered the Justice Department, and he is now a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Columbia School of Law. And he wrote an op-ed piece in this week's New York Times. He's impeachable, referring to the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. So we're looking into that. Let's now go to the subject of U.S. foreign policy and an overall geostrategic position of the United States. I'm speaking with Zbigniew Brzezinski, the author of Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower. And clearly, after the Cold War ended, the post-Cold War architecture wasn't constructed, and your book points that out. Was it because there was just a conceptual failure throughout the government and the bureaucracies in terms of the notion that national security was now a kind of antiquated notion, and subnational and transnational threats suddenly emerged and transcended these traditional threats?
Well, that may have been in part the prevailing attitude within the sort of academic, intellectual, expert community. But on the political leadership level, I think it was something different, namely that, first of all, the terminal phase of the Cold War came so suddenly that there really wasn't much time to think about the larger, broader global implications of the change for the United States and its role in the world. And there was a certain failure of imagination on the part of the first president who became the first global leader, namely George H. Bush. That continued under Clinton, who simply relied very broadly on the notion that we live in the age of globalization, and that is the essential formula for working out the globe's problems, and that it is going to be a self-operative mechanism. And that bred a certain personal as well as national self-indulgence in the United States. And then later on in the administration of the third global leader, all of that after 9/11 was translated into a very Manichaean confrontation of good versus evil, resulting ultimately in the misadventure in Iraq.
And there's also been, though, a kind of struggle, if you will, between the strain of foreign policy pragmatism and the new activism that the neoconservatives have brought, this kind of reckless utopianism. And I mean, you must remember the Committee on the Present Danger. After all, they attacked President Carter. Explain to me, if you will, how this insurgent group, who don't really have any intellectual track record, were able to use the media in this way to basically get this country to the point it's in now.
I tried to address that issue in my book. I have a chapter called The Mists of Victory. The Mists of Victory. Namely, that the sudden unexpected victory in the Cold War, which transformed the United States into the only and first global power in human history, it produced a rather perplexing vacuum of analysis and thought about the outside world. And then one of the emerging answers in the course of an internal debate was precisely what you have referred to, which is the neocon, rather simplistic black and white views on the world, with some of the members of the old Committee on the Present Danger taking part in this, but a younger generation of neocon activists preoccupied very heavily with the Middle East and with Israel becoming the dominant group. And that was nurtured as an alternative, but it really wasn't dominant throughout the Clinton years, and wasn't even dominant in the election of George W. Bush, who tended to oscillate towards the more traditional realist school with a touch of what he called conservative compassion. It became dominant largely as a consequence of 9/11, the shock effect it had on the American public, the epiphany it prompted in the president himself, who then embraced many of the concepts of that group, a number of whose supporters were already entrenched in the administration, and translated it into a doctrine of his own presidency, presented to the American people with demagogic fervor, and to the American people at that moment being very susceptible to that appeal because of the shock of 9/11.
But then you have this war that they brought about, which is both 9/11 and the Iraq War have been absent in accountability in terms of the obvious manifest failure of the Iraq War. And one wonders whether this is a deeper problem in our democracy, that our opposition failed us, the Democratic Party, many of the titans in the party voted for this war, and they're haunted by that vote to this day. And the press, And the press failed us. So is it because people like Brent Scowcroft just didn't want to go on television and be barked at by people like Cliff May?
Well, actually, you know, to give credit where credit due, Brent Scowcroft was critical early on. He and I probably were the two most prominent former senior administration officials who took a publicly very quizzical stand, if I may use a euphemism here.
Right.
So there were people against it, but you're basically right. There was a failure, first of all, in the mass media. A lot of the journalists, a lot of the newspapers went along like sheep. And there was a failure of leadership in Congress with some very prominent Democratic leaders now campaigning for the presidency, being quite articulate in supporting what the president was advocating. And that, to repeat myself, I do ascribe to the atmosphere generated by 9/11 and to the very skillful exploitation by the president and his team of this self-declared war on terror, whatever that means, justifying the notion that we are a nation at war. A nation at war doesn't change its commanders-in-chief in midstream, and we have to be quite ruthless in that war because the enemy is so ruthless.
So, Brzezinski, your book grades the last three presidents, and I can't imagine they're thrilled with that. But you take these are the yardsticks, if you will: Atlantic Alliance, post-Soviet space, Far East, Middle East, proliferation, peacekeeping, environment, global trade, and/slash poverty. Overall, you give President Bush the one: tactical skill, but missed strategic opportunities. President Clinton an uneven sea, a major gap between potential and performance, and President Bush, the current president, a failed F, a simplistic dogmatic worldview, prompts self-destructive unilateralism. I have the feeling, though, given the rigidity of the situation now and the standoff between the Senate, the House and Senate, and the president, that the other shoe may drop in Iraq. I had William Odom on last Sunday on the program, and you, of course, worked with him in the National Security Council. He thinks that it's quite possible we can be driven out of that place, and that he feels the military over there are derelict in not planning for that eventuality.
Well, we will not be driven out unless we decide to leave, but we may have to decide to leave. In other words, I don't believe the war has been lost militarily. It has been lost politically. If we wanted to win it militarily, theoretically we could. We could put in 500,000 men. We could wage it far more brutally. But we're not going to do either of these two things. As a country, we're not inclined to wage a brutal counterinsurgency against civilian populations. And also the country doesn't want to go back to the draft and have hundreds of thousands of Americans sent over there. So as a practical matter, our military options are limited, and therefore the war has not been won politically. But I have a different fear from Bill Odom, who's a good friend of mine and with whom we have very similar views. Namely, that the war may drag on, and then through some misadventure, it may even escalate. And if it escalates, it may enlarge to involve Iran. Not necessarily with premeditation, but simply by the logic of an unpredictable dynamic of warfare. I'll just give you an example. Think of that Iranian-British incident several weeks ago involving some British sailors. Suppose these hadn't been these young British sailors, but let's say U.S. Marines. I don't think they would have surrendered like sheep. And suppose the president then went on the radio on the television that evening and said, in the naval incident provoked by the Iranians, 15 heroic American Marines were slaughtered today. I don't think he would stop there. I think quite rightly he would say, I am therefore ordering a retaliation. We might not have attacked the Iranian nuclear facilities, that would be overdoing it by far, but we might bomb an Iranian naval base. And then the Iranians would respond with something. And you can see how an escalatory dynamic might be set in motion.
Well, you can count about four or five wars already in Iraq. The war against the Sunni, the war amongst the militias, the war against al-Qaeda, the low-intensity war against Iran, the civil war, and the possibility of a regional war, which you've just pointed out, which would be a consequence of an attack on Iran. But in general, let me just quote your book, the misguided U.S. posture carries two long-range dangers, that the United States will eventually lose all its Arab friends and thus the capacity to influence their attitudes, with the consequence that for all intents and purposes, the United States will be politically expelled from the Middle East, and that Israel will become involved in prolonged asymmetrical warfare, negating its technological military advantage, with the consequence that Israel will eventually be at mortal risk. In other words, you can't nuke your way out of an insurgency. So your overall analysis is pretty grim.
Yes, it is. I think, look, we are running the risk of losing our position in the Middle East, and the consequences I outline would then ensue. This is why I think a change of course politically is necessary. It is a political defeat we are suffering. Now, again, if we wanted to conquer the Middle East, we could send 2 million men to the Middle East. We send many more than that to the Far East and to Europe in World War II. But we're not going to do it. The country doesn't want it. The country is sensible. It doesn't want that kind of an adventure. So that option is out. So what's left? What's left is the necessity of a political strategy that copes simultaneously with three immediate dilemmas. One, how to terminate our military presence in Iraq. Two, how to avoid escalation with Iran and engage Iran in serious negotiations, which will last several years before they become fruitful. And three, how do we accelerate a resolution of the overdue Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is poisoning the political atmosphere in the region against us?
Well, you make it clear that President Bush II, not that there's much doubt about this, has been derelict in a sense. He treated it as a sort of public relations disaster. And there's also, I think, you could make the case that the Israeli lobby, in effect, has been a victim of its own success. If you have too much influence, you end up talking to yourself. And I fear that what's happening now is that the Israeli right, who are waiting for Olmert to stumble, may have by dragging their heels so long, they may well have created a self-fulfilling prophecy that you see you can't deal with the Palestinians because there's nobody left on that side, you know, because
that's exactly right. And, you know, the Hezbollah business is a preview of things to come. Now, the Israeli right may be itching to settle scores with the Hezbollah and may want to have another round, and presumably in a conventional sense they might even win it. But the point is, it will simply enlarge the scope of the conflict and deepen it and make it more enduring. And there's no winning in that context. There's no victory in that context. In the end, the smaller party, the richer party, the more comfortable party becomes totally exhausted.
Well, you wonder how the Israeli right can answer the obvious question, which is how come Hamas and Hezbollah have had so much influence in that region, obviously with Iranian help? In other words, how come you've allowed Iran's surrogate in your back door? You know, in other words, why didn't you take care of the situation? You're the stronger power, and now we're in a situation.
Well, but how could they?
Well, I think since 67, they had a choice, didn't they, about how you deal with those people?
Well, but they couldn't, you know, reach Iran. That's a little too far.
No, I'm saying Iran has been able to essentially, I believe that the popularity of Hamas and Hezbollah is that they provide social services.
That's right.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
Okay, and a certain sense also of political dignity.
Right.
They don't feel that they're just passive, impotent victims of a much stronger party. They feel they can stand up and fight and inflict casualties. And that gives them something which is very important to people, particularly people who feel downtrodden, namely a sense of dignity.
But the downside is once a secular struggle becomes a religious one, it's much, much more intractable.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And this is the great danger of this conflict continuing, because it really transforms the value system of the Arabs of the Middle East, who for a while at least saw the United States actually as a kind of quasi, and I emphasize the word quasi, quasi-liberating force from the colonial imperial era of the French and the British.
Let me just, again, Zbigniew Brzezinski, broaden out this discussion to what you pose in the book, Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower. And that's clearly the deficit in strategic thinking. And Iraq, of course, is a perfect example of strategic blindness, because once you make a strategic error of that magnitude, there's no tactical fix, it seems. General Hayden, when he was in his confirmation hearings, talked about the need for a kind of cadre of strategists. How would you go about making this country more strategically smart?
You know, that's a question which is fundamental. It's really important, but for which there's no simple, easy answer. Obviously, the answer has to start, in a general sense, with education and with the mass media. And then more specifically, eventually, with the role of the president. Let me simply say that the vast majority of Americans are not informed about the world by the mass media, which don't even try. I think the evening news on the major networks has become a joke. There are hardly any newspapers, except maybe 3 or 4 or 5, who give any serious coverage to world affairs. And in schools, most Americans are not taught much about the history of other countries, and not even much about geography. I cite in my book some staggering statistics about how many allegedly educated Americans can't locate on the map either Iraq or Afghanistan, where we are engaged in warfare, nor Great Britain, which is our ally, and I believe a very high percentage couldn't locate the Pacific Ocean. And then last but not least, I think the presidents really have to make much more of an effort to educate the country about the world, about the key global issues, and not just spout slogans about America and how good America is and how we are threatened by enemies and leaving it at that. The president really has an obligation, since he has the greatest freedom to maneuver in the area of foreign policy. He really has an obligation, or she, to systematically, periodically address the country about its place and its responsibility in this much more interwoven global community that now is a reality.
Well, just in closing, Zbigniew Brzezinski, is our politics a Pavlovian exercise? In other words, we've gotten into such a mess, and after all, you know, President Bush won three debates, arguably, in 2000 against a very smart man, Al Gore, and he came across as the regular guy, and perhaps to some extent people voted for him because he thought he was just like them. I have spoken a number of times to Colonel Wilkerson, who's the chief of staff of Colin Powell, and he's critical of what's happened in the first term. And I said, but you were a part of the first term, so how could you be that critical of your record? And he said, you don't understand. Me and Powell, we were doing damage control. So it could have been so much worse. So,
well, it could be, but it could also be worse in the future. Namely, this week, when was it? Thursday night, I believe, there was a debate among the presidential Republican contenders. I listened to it, and my hair was standing up. I have never heard such ignorant drivel being dished out about the world as by these people allegedly contesting the position of U.S. president. It was really appalling. It was a series of simplistic slogans, massive exaggeration of threats, and a kind of jingoist demagogy that really made me ashamed. And yet these are the competitors for the presidency of the United States.
And you have to add to that Duncan Hunter was openly belligerent towards Iran, in fact, talking about the need to go to war.
Absolutely. I mean, totally without any sense of responsibility, or for that matter, much understanding of the complexity of the situation and of possible alternative options. But others were in that category too, including, you know, the principal contenders. They were also mouthing slogans and essentially being jingoist. Now, maybe they're appealing to the most conservative, right-wing, sectarian elements in the Republican Party who vote in the primaries, because increasingly public opinion polls show a massive majority in the country that is much more sober and wants a re-examination of what we have been doing. So there is a ray of hope, and certainly I believe, as my title of my book suggests, that we will have a second chance.
Right. But there is an inherent contradiction here in terms of pandering to the evangelicals, and that is you cannot fight a war abroad against religious fundamentalists if you're in bed with them at home.
Yeah, well, that's a slogan, exactly.
Yes. I thank you for joining us.
Well, it's nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's formerly the National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter and is a counselor and trustee at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor of American Foreign Policy at the School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University in Washington, D.C. And he's the author of a new book, Second Chance, Three Presidents and the Crisis of American Superpower. I'm now speaking with Daniel Levy, who is a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Policy Initiative of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He was the lead Israeli drafter of the Geneva Initiative and directed policy planning and international efforts at the Geneva Campaign headquarters in Tel Aviv. He was a member of the Israeli delegation at the Taba negotiations with the Palestinians in January of 2001 and of the negotiating team for the Oslo B agreement from May to September 1995 under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. And this week in Israel, the country has been fixated by massive demonstrations in the streets against Prime Minister Olmert because of the Winograd Commission. But I have to say, Daniel Levy, that if a leader takes a country, you know, an immature, impetuous, leader without military experience takes a country to war and it's a disaster, Israel at least has accountability. I mean, where's the accountability over here? I mean, the more I read about and watch Israeli politics, the more I'm embarrassed at how much more vigorous a democracy and a press the Israelis have.
I couldn't agree more. And as difficult as it is to read the report that was published this week, the Vinograd Commission report, 180 pages in Hebrew, very serious text, it still would be more difficult had such a report not been published. And it really is a badge of credit, I think, that the Prime Minister himself appointed a commission that has come out totally independent, has talked about the severe failure of the Chief of Staff of the Army, of the Defense Minister, of the Prime Minister himself, and has documented in unflinching detail the lack of preparedness, the haste with which the decision to go to war was taken, the lack of an exit strategy, the lack of alternatives considered, whether indeed the military option was pursued too early and too vigorously without considering political and diplomatic options. And I would like to believe that although, of course, last summer's conflict is behind us and that can't be changed, that at least this report will be a sign to Israeli future leaders, be careful. You will be called on it if you embrace military solutions in a not serious way and when they're not necessary. So, difficult week, but an important week. And as you say, would be nice if that were to be seen elsewhere.
And in terms of the foreign minister, who is the also, the, I think, the deputy prime minister in the Kadima, the ruling party, she pretty clearly broke with him. And I mean, I don't imagine there's any secret that she may have political ambitions. But how's that going to play out?
Well, Ian, it's been a fascinating week in Israeli politics, and Israeli politics is brutal at the best of times. But what has happened this week is that the prime minister, who in the immediate aftermath of the report was on very shaky ground, has actually, in the last days, managed to stabilize his position. And one of the main reasons is that the focal point for opposition, the potential focal point, who, as you have pointed out, is the foreign minister. Her name is Tzipi Livni. She comes from Olmert's party. And there was a sense that maybe the opposition inside his party would coalesce around her. Now, she called for his resignation, but she did not resign herself from government. And it was one of those moments where you see a politician deflate in front of your very eyes, because apparently she made a political misjudgment by saying that while the prime minister should resign, in her opinion, if he didn't, then she would continue to serve as his foreign minister. And as I said, her name is Tzipi Livni. The phrase being used in blogs in Israel and in the news media in Israel is Tzipi Pitputi, which in rough translation is Tzipi blah, blah, blah. In other words, when the chips were down, she is being depicted as someone who did not have the courage of her conviction and is no longer seen as the alternative. Right now, at least, that could change. But today, her political currency is way on the down.
And what about Netanyahu? He's obviously chafing in the wings, right?
Yes. Look, the current polls suggest that if Israel were to go to elections today, and if the current leadership options were as they are today, then Netanyahu has a clear advantage. By the way, that doesn't even approach a 50% support or approval rating. It's not that Israelis are enthusiastically embracing Netanyahu. He is simply seen as the alternative. In fact, if the ruling party, Kadima, were to switch leaders, and if the center-left coalition partner, the Labour Party, were to switch leaders as well, because the current defense minister is head of the Labour Party and he is just as severely criticized. So if both of those parties were to change their leaderships, then Netanyahu's position does not look so strong. The fact that the main alternative, if we go to elections today, is Netanyahu, is one of the reasons that there is not much appetite amongst the current and within the current ruling coalition to accept early elections. And in fact, some of the peace groups in Israel did not join the demonstrations because they said this would be deeply irresponsible to hand power to Netanyahu.
And what about Amir Yalon and the notion that the Labour could reinvent themselves? I mean, the leader, Peres, the defence minister, he was absolutely eviscerated. Of course, he didn't help himself by recently watching military manoeuvres through binoculars with the lens caps on.
it was one of those photos that the words just cannot describe.
It's Israel's Dukakis moment, I guess.
Really. It really was a very sad moment. But he has not been up to the job of being defense minister, and he was seen as a great hope, and that has not been realized. Now, as you point out, the Labour Party is going to elect a leader. On the 28th of May, the Israeli Labour Party will have primary elections. The current leader, the defense minister, is one of the candidates, although he apparently does not have a good chance of winning. The two lead candidates, one you mentioned, Amir Yalon, comes from a military background, was head of the Navy, was head of the Shin Bet, which is Israel's internal security services, and is someone who's coming with something of a fresh approach, very in favor of serious negotiations with the Palestinians and of Israel making a big diplomatic move. His main challenger is a name that will be familiar to people. He's the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak. He has run a campaign of basically keeping silent so as not to remind people why they threw him out of office in the first place. Within the Labour Party, he does, though, have a chance. And the main question for Labour will be, and that question will probably only finally be asked after the Labour leadership election, is whether Labour is willing to continue to sit in a government led by the current Prime Minister, Mr. Olmert. Because as things stand right now, it seems that the Prime Minister will ride out this initial wave of opposition following the report's publication. And the next test may well be, if indeed he survives till the end of May, may well be, once Labour has elected its leader, whether he can convince Labour to stay in the government and what he has to do to convince them. Many of us would hope, at the very minimum, a serious relaunching of a political process would be the necessary thing to happen.
And in terms of Daniel Levy, which it certainly occurs to me that that's the only card that Olmert can play, there have been some feelers sent to the Syrians. Do you think that they, and you know that back during the Clinton administration, they came pretty close to making a deal. So, and one of the things that I think we miss over here about Israeli politics and particularly negotiations and deals with their neighbors, the most famous, of course, the Camp David Accords, they were secretly negotiated before the icing on the cake in the Rose Garden. The same is true of the negotiations you're involved with the Palestinians. That was all done secretly, and then eventually it ended in the Rose Garden. I'm not belittling the U.S. role, but I'm just saying that stuff happens behind the scenes, and then we find out about it later. So, is there any reason to have any sense of optimism here that even a wounded prime minister can pull off something?
I think that, first of all, yes, even a wounded prime minister can pull off something, and the reason for that, and by extension for the optimism, is that more and more Israelis today are cognizant of the fact that Israel does need to reach negotiated agreements with its neighbors. Israel needs a final border. And one of the things, by the way, that the report has done has also been to give people a little reminder of the limits of the use of military force. So that's the reason for optimism. And were Olmert to choose to go in that direction, whether by secret negotiations or by other negotiations, then despite all the opposition to him, he may well be able to carry the country with him. Obviously, it's not the most propitious of circumstances. And unfortunately, we have been there before, where a weakened prime minister tries to go for a big stretch on a peace effort when Barak failed. So these aren't the ideal circumstances, but I think nonetheless, if he tries, it might just work out. One of the things that we need to bear in mind is that the regional atmosphere is not conducive either. And one of the questions is that beginning to shift now after the meeting between the American Secretary of State, Secretary Rice, and the Syrian Foreign Minister, Walid Mualim, in the sidelines of the Iraq conference just before the weekend in Sharm el-Sheikh? If we're now in a place where the ridiculous notion that you don't engage with your adversaries is beginning to be put behind us, then maybe the regional conditions for a renewed peace process will improve. The other thing, though, that we're not seeing a change in, which I think has also been a terrible mistake, is this pushback against the notion of trying to work with political Islamists once they're in government. When we describe all the political Islamists as one monolithic bloc, and I speak here especially about Hamas being in the Palestinian government, then we make a mistake. Hamas is not al-Qaeda. I disagree with Hamas. But we have to try and work out a way that you can forge a peace process with the Palestinians that involves the moderates and Abu Mazen, and he's the Palestinian president, but can also try and keep the Islamists who have decided to join parliamentary politics inside the tent. Because if we try and force them out undemocratically, then the consequences are very likely to be very dire. So lots of problems still. Guarded optimism because the publics are ready and because this may be Olmert's only way to save himself. But unfortunately, some of the fundamentals of the policy are still not where they need to be.
Well, just in closing, Daniel Levy, obviously the great victim, if you will, apart from the fact that this war devastated Israel and more to the point devastated Lebanon, and none of the objectives were met. And it always seemed extraordinary to me that two soldiers are captured and in retaliation a country gets blown up. But obviously people should read the entire report because, as I say, we don't have anything equivalent over here. But the long and the short of it is back to the analogies between the Bush disaster and the Olmert disaster and the lack of accountability on our side. I mean, at the end of the day, when you lose your deterrent power, which is what it appears the IDF have suffered from, and to some extent, it's quite likely that we will be defeated. In fact, you know, our Senate leader says we're already defeated in Iraq it won't mean that the United States is not the superpower it is. It'll just mean that in the eyes of the jihadis that we're a paper tiger. So in many ways, that is a more lasting damage. I mean, here we are spending more money than the rest of the world combined on defense, and we can't deter our enemies, and we can't win wars. So I was interested, previously to you coming on, I had Zbigniew Brzezinski on here, and he talks about, let me just quote you briefly what he says about this misguided situation in Iraq. This misguided U.S. posture carries two long-range dangers: that the United States will eventually lose all its Arab friends and thus the capacity to influence their attitudes, with the consequence that for all intents and purposes the United States will be politically expelled from the Middle East, and that Israel will become involved in prolonged asymmetrical warfare, negating its technological military advantage, with the consequence that Israel will eventually be at mortal risk. Is that a lesson warning resonating anywhere in Israel?
It's resonating where I am. Ian, I think Zbigniew Brzezinski is a man who we would all do very well to listen to. He is sometimes described as someone who's not pro-Israel enough. And I would really say amen to the quote that you just read, because he's absolutely right. It is not a good thing to lose one's deterrence. Now, that means several things. One of the things it should mean is that you deploy militarily only sparingly and when it's absolutely necessary and when it's very thought through. Now, some people look at the current American administration and the policy and the neocon-driven policy and the agenda for transformational change in the Middle East, and they say, oh, well, isn't this great for Israel? And this is all about making conditions better for Israel. And that could not be more wrong. And what you are seeing in Israel is a tone of commentary that I'm not used to. And I'm not saying it's what, where most people are at, or even where most of the leadership is at. But you're beginning to see very serious thinkers in Israel saying the current U.S. administration's policy has been a disaster, not only for America, not only for moderates in the region, but also for Israel, because it has so emboldened the very hardliners that it was apparently designed to weaken. And one of the things that comes out in the report that we started by speaking about into the Lebanon war is that the foreign ministry was not nearly involved enough in decision-making in Israel, that the Israeli army was the only place where serious strategic planning was done, and that you did not have nearly enough of a balance between military versus diplomatic political considerations during the war. And it comes out with a series of suggestions about how to redress that imbalance. So if I may, what I think I would draw from this is that one of the things we missed during last summer's Lebanon war was there was not the exit strategy that Israel anticipated, namely a diplomatically engaged America that after 3-4 days, and it comes out very clearly from the report, that some of the key Israeli players fully expected that this confrontation would only last 3 or 4 days, not 34 days, because they expected that a U.S.-led international community would turn around and say, okay, you had your little conflagration, you know that a continued military operation is not going to return the two soldiers, and this needs to be dealt with politically and diplomatically, which is what happened in the end, of course. But by the end, Israel had been military weakened and its deterrence had suffered a serious blow. But rather than the Americans providing a ladder for Israel, well, actually, they did provide the ladder. But rather than saying, here, this is a ladder for you to climb down on, the encouragement was climb further up the ladder. And in fact, there are suggestions that the Americans said, if you decide to hit Syria, we will not object. So what we miss as Israel, and true, we have our own responsibilities and we've got to sort our own problems out as well. But what we miss is an America that, put most simply and in Zbigniew Brzezinski's terms, is acting in its own self-interest. For America's own interest, it should be re-engaged in pursuing diplomatic, political conflict resolution in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors, because that will help restore American credibility, America's capacity to build and lead alliances in the region. And, of course, it will take a key card away from the radicals who really do have it in for us. So that's what one has to hope will be one of the outcomes in the next months, or maybe only in 2 years when you have a new leadership here. I don't want to give up on the current leadership yet, but it's not encouraging.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Daniel Levy.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. So just speaking then with Daniel Levy. He's a senior fellow and the director of the Middle East Policy Initiative of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He was the lead Israeli draft of the Geneva Initiative, and he was also a member of the Israeli delegation to the Taba negotiations with the Palestinians in January of 2001, and he was on the negotiating team of the Oslo B Agreement from May to September 1995 under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. I'm now speaking with Frank Bowman, who holds the Floyd R. Gibson Endowed Chair at the University of Missouri Columbia School of Law. Following his graduation from Harvard Law School in 1979, Professor Bowman entered the U.S. Department of Justice as part of an honor graduate program. He was a prosecutor for a number of years in the Justice Department, and he also has written an opinion piece that struck me this week in the New York Times. He's impeachable, you know, and of course the he being Alberto Gonzalez, who was about to return to Capitol Hill, this time to testify on Thursday before the House Judiciary Committee. Tell me, just before we get into your notion of that the Attorney General could be impeachable. Certainly, it's apparently in Article 2 of the Constitution, grants the Congress the power to impeach the President, the Vice President, and all civil officers, and he's under that category. But just to start with, Frank Bowman, what can we expect on Thursday from Round 2 of the Attorney General on Capitol Hill?
Well, first of all, Ian, thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
I would hesitate to predict what we will see. What I would certainly hope we might see is that the members of the committee might inquire a little further along some of the lines that perhaps necessarily were left unpursued in the Senate. The structure of the questioning in all of these hearings is that each of the members has a limited time, and they do the best that they can with the time they have. But there were certainly some lines of inquiry that I think might have been pursued a little bit further, particularly with respect to the Attorney General's dealings with the White House on some of these firings and so forth.
Well, in your piece in the New York Times this week, where you talk about that Gonzalez could in fact be impeached, and you also point out that the threshold that they're used to, high crimes and misdemeanors, is not all of what comes into play, that conduct grossly incompatible with the office held and subversive of that office and of our constitutional system of government. And your conclusion here is that the real question is whether Republicans and Democrats are prepared to defend the constitutional authority of Congress against the implicit claim of an administration that it can do what it pleases and, when called to account, send an Attorney General of the United States to Capitol Hill to commit amnesia on its behalf. So I think, you know, if I was in the Congress and in the Senate, I would have been insulted, and I think some of the Republican former supporters of the Attorney General clearly were insulted. But I mean, the bottom line here is that you're saying that somebody's got to stand up for truth, right?
I think that's certainly a good part of it. I mean, the impeachment power, first of all, let's begin with a disclaimer here. I don't necessarily expect Congress to leap into the breach and start filing articles of impeachment against the Attorney General, though it might be that would be a good thing. But I think they need to at least think about the fact that they have that power and why the power exists. And at bottom, the impeachment power is in the Constitution, I think, for probably three reasons. I mean, first of them is to guarantee sort of the personal integrity of high federal government officials, and that's why it's most often used for federal judges. They have life tenure, and there's really no other mechanism to remove them if they display a sort of lack of integrity. At the other end of the spectrum, and this is the point I was making in the Times piece, in really egregious cases, the impeachment power is a power that's given Congress in part to defend its status as a co-equal branch, particularly with the executive. And Congress has an absolute right to inquire into the conduct of a whole variety of things that the executive branch does. And in this particular instance, we have a series of folks, the U.S. attorneys who are the subject of this controversy, eight of them, who are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, are tremendously important officials in their states and regions. And Congress has the power to inquire into why they were dismissed. And it's one thing to dismiss them for whatever reason, but it's another thing for the executive to simply refuse to give a reasonable account of why it did so. And I think Congress has a right to insist that it give a reasonable account and a truthful account, a full account. And Congress also has the right, I think, particularly if the Attorney General of all people comes up and gives statements which are certainly open to serious question in terms of their candor, to remove him if need be, not only to ensure that he is an honest individual in his position, but to ensure that that the executive lives up to its responsibility to give a fair accounting of what it does to Congress and the American people.
Well, I think you could have interpreted his appearance before the Senate as a sort of almost a poke in the eye to the senators, because it appeared that the Attorney General made the choice to make himself look foolish in order to protect whoever he was protecting, because he clearly did not want to admit how these firings took place and why and who had the authority, even though he claimed to have the authority. So I don't know whether in round two they're going to get any further, but it struck me, you know, just from my point of view, as a guy that was basically almost like, it's almost like, some, you know, somebody in the mafia is testifying and, you know, I didn't rat him out, you know. He didn't rat him out, you know, that is a pretty low threshold for the Attorney General of the United States.
Well, I mean, you know, I suppose it is at least possible that he is as utterly disconnected from the operation of his own department and the decision-making process of the executive branch as he portrayed himself. But that seems to me so unlikely as to verge on impossible. And that being so, I think you do have to ask, why was the choice made, not only by Gonzalez, but also those people with whom he plainly consulted before going up on the Hill? Why did he make this choice? And it is a puzzlement. It certainly leads one to at least, and maybe this sort of goes back to your original question, what ought we to expect or hope from the House hearing? I certainly would hope that the House would inquire further into, you know, the lines of questioning that, you know, are kind of left open by the, or suggested by the fact that he seemed to be covering for somebody or something. It certainly leads you to wonder.
Well, you know, the former, I think, Deputy Attorney General Comey has spoken out in defense of the U.S. attorneys that were fired. I mean, it's pretty clear that Carol Lam here in San Diego was fired because she was going up. She'd gotten Randy Duke Cunningham, and she'd also was going after a bunch of a senior CIA guy and some crooked contractors. Paul Charlton in Arizona was dismissed, and he was investigating Rick Renzi, the congressman who's just stepped down. Got Dan Bogdan in Nevada was fired because he was investigating Jim Gibbons, former congressman who was elected governor. And here in Los Angeles, we've got the case of Deborah Wong Yang, who was looking into a very powerful congressman, Jerry Lewis, who was the chair of the, up until recently, the chair of the powerful House Appropriations Committee. She looks like she was sort of took a very, very big job that may well have been arranged for her. So the fact that I can read this stuff, I'm reading that from the New York Times, this is all out in the open there. This, as a career prosecutor, this has got to be embarrassing to you and your colleagues, isn't it? That you know, I thought you guys at the DOJ were holding the line in terms of the truth in this country. That's the ultimately the standard that we rely on. We rely on the Department of Justice to set a standard of unimpeachable truth in the country, don't we?
Well, I mean, two things, I guess. One, I mean, I think it would be, as upset as I am about Mr. Gonzalez's behavior on the Hill and the conduct of a lot of things at the Department recently, I think it, you know, one should not necessarily jump to conclusions in individual cases that particular people are, particularly U.S. attorneys, were necessarily fired because of politically sensitive investigations that they were involved in. I think it's early days to arrive at that conclusion. For example, Carol Lam, who I have the greatest respect for, I know her somewhat, and I certainly know a good many people in her office, you know, maybe her dismissal had something to do with investigations of politicians, but there also was some dispute about her conduct of prosecution policy on the border. So, I mean, I think one wants to be cautious here about drawing, you know, leaping to conclusions about individual cases. That said, the overall pattern is really, really troubling. And in that respect, I agree with you very much. I mean, I have great respect for Jim Comey, former deputy AG who testified the other day. And I think he expressed very well the sense that a great many of us have that, you know, the department is not just any department of government. This is not like, you know, the Department of Agriculture, though, you know, the Department of Agriculture is very obviously very important. The department really does serve as a guarantor that everyone in American society, big and small, plays by the rules. And, you know, it's not perfect, Lord knows. But if you think about the role that it's played over the past decades, and that it continues to play in so many areas, and, you know, in the economy, it does antitrust, it does securities violations, I mean, fraud of every kind, Enron, defense contracting, healthcare, banking. You know, in politics, both local, state, and federal, DOJ, prosecutors, you know, are sort of the first line of defense against political corruption. Civil rights, you know, prosecutions or in cases rising from the Old South to, you know, the LA Police Department in modern days. In drug crime, the department does things that nobody else can do because of its long reach. I mean, and essential to all of those functions is the department's reputation that it enjoys within the justice system and in the populace more broadly as being entirely non-political, or certainly as entirely non-political as any human agency can be. You know, at the margins, changes in administration are going to bring changes in policy emphasis. Of course they will, and they should. But, I mean, at the pointy end of the spear, at the places where, you know, where U.S. attorneys and their assistants do their jobs out in the field, the effectiveness of the department rests on the faith, faith by judges, juries, and the public, that the department doesn't play any favorites, that politics plays no role in the choices that we make. And that is the most corrosive aspect of this scandal. And I think, as is so often the case, the fact that the Attorney General is in trouble over the firing of these U.S. attorneys is in part a reflection of growing dissatisfaction with him, with previous, you know, folks running the Department of Justice, and with this administration generally, concerned that there has been a creeping politicization of the department and both its policy making and you know, potentially its sort of case specific decisions, and that cannot be allowed to go on, and it is just immensely corrosive to the entire rule of law in this country and its reputation indeed abroad.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Frank Bowman. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us here today. Again, Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Endowed Chair at the University of Missouri School of Law at Columbia, and he was a career prosecutor in the Justice Department. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer.